Welcome back to episode 21 of The Fearless Flyer. My name's Grant. I'm one of your hosts, and my co-host is James. Hello, James.
Hello, everyone. I hope we're doing okay. Yeah, we're back with another episode, episode 21. So did you want to just discuss quickly what we discussed in the last episode?
Yeah, the previous episode, we talked about the APU, the auxiliary power unit, some ground support equipment, and various ways of starting an aircraft. In this episode, we're going to talk about the autopilot and the flight instrumentation. So let's get into it.
Yeah, so before there was autopilot and like the modern day instrumentation we have these days, so back in the early days of flying, the aircraft, as they got bigger and started flying longer distances, the flight crew was quite large as well and consists of quite a few people. So you had the two pilots, the captain and the co-pilot. Then you had a flight engineer, a navigator, and a radio operator.
Yeah, that's right. There were a lot of people there. So basically, the pilots, they flew the aircraft, and the flight engineer, he looked after the engines and the systems. And the navigator, he navigated the aircraft from A to B. And the radio operator, he talked to the ground controllers.
Yeah, but you move along to aircraft these days, and in today's modern aircraft, there are still two pilots. However, all the other jobs have been taken away by technology. So one of the first jobs to disappear was the radio operator. So that a radio panel was placed next to the pilot. And whilst one of the pilots is flying, the other could then operate the radio. After all, pilots still in small aircraft. So, yeah.
So rest in peace, the radio operator.
Rest in peace. So rest in peace to the radio operator.
Yeah.
Definitely boomer you are.
Yeah. So next to go was the navigator. And this was before the days of GPS. So we placed some radio navigation panels near the pilot, and the pilot who is operating the radio, he has plenty of time. So he too can now operate the navigation panel as well. Around this time, the navigation ground aids and long-range navigation concepts were developing quite rapidly. And coupled about this time with advances in computer technology, pilots could preload latitude and longitude coordinates into a navigation computer, and the aircraft could navigate its way by these coordinates. Anyhow, what this meant was rest in peace, thy navigator. Incidentally, nowadays, instead of using latitude and longitude coordinates, we give them a name with five letters in them, and we call these waypoints. For example, some waypoint names are Nimva, Vaxim, Parar, Nirib. And for example, Nirib, it's located at 30.287 degrees south and 112.49.35 degrees east. What we do is we just give them names instead of calling out all the latitude and longitude.
So after the navigator, who was next on the chopping block?
Yeah, next on the chopping block was the flight engineer. Now, the flight engineer, they looked after the engines, the air conditioning, the lifeblood of the aircraft being hydraulics, electrics, pneumatics, and they moved fuel around. And they'd deal with any problems such as leaks or engine fires, etc.
So earlier large piston aircraft were pretty complex, as were the earlier large four-engine jet aircraft. And system reliability in those days wasn't as good as it was these days. So obviously a flight engineer was quite important, and they did hang in there for quite a while.
Yeah, but aircraft technology and reliability was improving significantly. And with the introduction of the Boeing 767 and the Airbus A300, whilst these earlier versions had a flight engineer's station, there was really no requirement for them anymore as a new concept was implemented. And on the Boeing, this was called the ICAS, which is an electronic system, and ICAS stands for Engine Indication and Crew Alerting System.
Yeah, and on Airbus, it's called the ECAM, which is the Electronic Centralized Aircraft Monitor. And a cool little fact I actually just found about the 767 you mentioned was that the only airline to ever have a 767 with a flight engineer was ANSET Airlines, and they were specifically requested it because of unions.
Yeah, and I think they were the launch customer for it, so that was part of the deal, but Boeing already had other ideas. And as a result, the flight deck on the 76, I flew it, it's quite large because the bulkhead, I think, they never moved it back once they got rid of the flight engineer, but I can't be 100% sure there. But basically, the airplane would monitor all these systems and it would highlight any of these issues to the pilots on a screen that they could both see between their flying instruments. And then they would action the relevant checklist. So rest in peace, flight engineer. I digress here a little bit. There's a lovely video on YouTube called The Flight Engineer's Lament. It's about 3.5 minute video, and I'll place it in the show notes. And in it, you'll see the flight engineer sitting behind the pilots with lots of dials and switches on the flight engineer's panel. But all this has been replaced with technology and a well thought out way in which it can be displayed to the pilots on various screens that are in front and between the both of them.
Did you want to talk about the instrumentation?
Yeah, the instrumentation, the very early days of flying, there are only a few instruments, those simply being how fast you were flying, which we called an airspeed indicator, how high you were flying, called an altimeter, and an instrument telling you how fast you were going up or down, called a VSI, or what that stands for, vertical speed indicator. Maybe a device called a turn and slip indicator, which would tell you how much bank or turn you had, and a compass so you could work out which way you were pointing. You were likely to have had some basic engine instruments as well, like the rev meter you might see in your car, and what we term an aviation tachometer, and maybe an oil pressure gauge or an oil temperature gauge.
Yeah, so let's just talk there about the most basic of flying instruments and how they work as such, that being the airspeed indicator, the altimeter, the vertical speed indicator, and the system for navigation, which has made the compass obsolete in aircraft.
So a really basic airspeed indicator would be a thin metal plate placed outside the flight deck or cockpit, and it'll be attached to the aircraft structure, say at one end. And as the aircraft goes faster, the piece of metal bends back further, and you put a scale underneath this and you have a very basic airspeed indicator.
But that obviously is extremely sort of primitive, considering the sort of range of technology we have in today's modern aircraft, and as well as the speed range that they fly at.
Yeah, that's right. So what aircraft use today is a measure between two pressure devices. And one is a pitot tube, which is a probe with a hole in it facing directly forward, and thus the airflow comes into this and it creates a high pressure inside the probe. The other is a static probe, which is generally on the side of the fuselage somewhere, and this measures the local air pressure.
What you're saying is that as the aircraft goes faster, the pitot pressure increases, the static pressure remains the same, and it's sort of the difference which is indicated to the pilots in the airspeed indicator.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Moving on, the altimeter or height gauge simply uses the static pressure source, and as we climb higher, the air pressure drops, and this air pressure is shown as a measurement on the altimeter. So that's a pretty straightforward instrument. The other one is the vertical speed indicator, or VSI. That shows a rate of climb or descent, and it also uses a static pressure, and it simply shows how much the rate of change is in our vertical speed. And it does this by using a diaphragm, which is simply another name for a flexible container. The static pressure line is connected to the instrument, and the static line is also connected within the instrument to a diaphragm. However, the one connected into the instrument has a slight restriction in the pipe, so it takes longer for the pressure to equalize than the one with the diaphragm pressure. And it's this difference in these pressures that's indicated, and it shows as a rate of vertical speed either going up or down.
Yeah, these instruments, obviously, as time has gone on, have become a lot more technical, not only in how they use the pressures, but also how other systems in play sort of remove the lag that's associated with the changing air pressures. Suffice to say that the technical enhancements have made them extremely accurate.
Yeah, that's right. Lastly, a really important flying instrument to back all these other instruments up, and an essential one for flying in cloud or at night, is the artificial horizon. If you look out the window of your car on a clear day, you see the ground or the road ahead of you below your line of vision, and above your line of vision, blue sky. And this is what an artificial horizon is. Thus, in level flight, the bottom of the instrument is generally brown, representing the ground, and the top half is blue, representing the sky. So if we point the nose down at the ground, the artificial horizon would mostly be all brown, and the opposite if we pointed the nose up, the instrument would mainly show blue. If likewise we went into a turn, like a 30-degree bank angle to the left, it would show this on the instrument as a 30-degree bank angle to the left. So this is an essential instrument, and it's been well designed, and it helps us to fly at night through clouds and perform approaches in basically no visibility.
Basically, with all these basic flying instruments as such, they've all been put onto one modern screen on a modern aircraft.
Yeah, that's right. On the Boeing, this is called the PFD, or Primary Flight Display, and it's lots of different colors and different symbols. But it saves us scanning around trying to find information quickly. And it also significantly reduces the amount of clutter that all these instruments would take up if placed in front of the pilot. Now, as you can imagine, the evolution of flying has meant more complexity, more systems to monitor, more speed, more power, more height, more range. The list goes on. But in essence, it means more instrumentation.
And obviously, well, in an aircraft, and especially a cockpit, space is limited. So before the advent of LCDs, or liquid crystal, there was a huge amount of instrumentation. So having a flight engineer's panel in the past was good, because you could dump a load of engine and other systems onto them to play with without having to mess with your key instruments as such. However, moving forward to today's modern aircraft and the multiple amounts of information that can now be displayed on only a few LCDs, with the ability to have some of the screens automatically show if certain parameters in the aircraft are being exceeded, is obviously quite a good feature.
Yeah, it's good. There's a lot less clutter. So for an example, on the 777, if we had an oil pressure problem, say on one engine, the ICAS screen between the two pilots will display the engine parameters. And then we'll use another screen below the ICAS screen to navigate some pages to the low oil pressure checklist. And we'll just follow that checklist accordingly.
Yeah, so let's lastly just move away from engines and such and talk about the navigation, not only from sort of A to B, but how you can land an aircraft nowadays in the likes of low cloud or fog.
So good point. There is another separate display next to the PFD. Remember, that's the one with all the basic flying instruments. And it's called the ND, which simply stands for navigation display. And that's on the Boeing. So that shows us where we are, where we're going, also what beacons or approach aids we're using. It shows us the terrain beneath us, weather radar, and where other aircraft are relative to us. But starting firstly with a few basics. As mentioned, the compass was the early basic concept of navigation. And as most folk know, the compass uses the Earth's magnetic field. It's good for basic navigation, but the compass wasn't really accurate, especially over long distances, as the Earth's magnetic field that the compass uses, it changes around the planet. So the compass wasn't really very accurate.
Then there's also another old form of navigation by using the stars, which obviously is not very good on a cloudy night or good in the day at all. So that's also another sort of limitation there.
Yeah.
Using stars to navigate.
Yeah, that's right. So aircraft would use ground-based radio beacons, and the navigator would tune into them to increase the aircraft's navigational accuracy.
However, obviously, the problem with this was that over the sea or remote areas such as like Siberia, there's no beacons. So then you're back to the basics of using compass and stars.
Yeah, that's right. Now, unfortunately, war and commercial competition have brought us some amazing technological advances, and none more so than how we navigate around our wee planet. During the early stages of the war, a system was implemented using long-range radio navigation, and this system was called LORAN, and it was short for long-range navigation. And it worked on a very low frequency, but it gave an accuracy of around 10 miles or 16 kilometers, up to a range of 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers away.
It was initially used for ships' convoys crossing the North Atlantic, but became really useful for aircraft later in the war, not only in the Atlantic, but also in the Pacific Ocean as well.
Yeah, and that's right. And because of its accuracy, then that meant that aircraft didn't need to carry as much fuel to allow for navigation inaccuracies, because that navigation was now much more accurate. It meant that they, in turn, could carry more payload.
In essence, beacons on the ground help the flight crew determine their location with a lot more accuracy.
Yeah.
And carry a lot less fuel.
Anyway, there were other developments, another radio system called Omega. But the most significant development before the GPS, which we know nowadays, was a spin-off of the space program. And it was called the Inertial Navigation System, or INS for short. Well, to be more precise, this inertial system was used earlier in the likes of the German V2 rocket program in World War II. But the space race really brought it into context for navigation without the reliance on external ground-based beacons.
This system was really cool. And the reason it was really cool was because if it didn't need any external equipment outside of the aircraft to make it work, that meant no radio beacons, no long-range frequencies, and no looking out of the window.
Yeah, that's right. So it uses a bit of equipment inside a box. The earlier days, these were gyros, and you had a computer to interpret what these gyros were doing. Nowadays, aircraft, they use laser gyros. But I won't bore you to death about the workings of them. Suffice to say, they were very accurate. So the system, the IN system, only needed to know where it was before the aircraft moved, so a latitude and longitude position. And thereafter, the sensors would feel the movements of the aircraft, and it would feed these into a computer, and the computer would translate the movement to a display, kind of like the map display on today's modern GPS.
So it was a great military application as well, because you couldn't jam it, deceive it with any false radio broadcasts, or destroy enemy ground beacons, or in the case of GPS, destroy any, say, GPS satellites.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that was a good system. And that leads us nicely on to the GPS, or the global positioning system. Most people would have used it in their cars, and it works by using lots of satellites flying away above us. And in essence, it's the same concept as LORAN. It's a system to get a fix of where we are on the planet, and it's very accurate. So our position is always shown on this navigation display, much as like where you are in your car as you're driving along.
And the GPS, I just heard on the radio, the system costs around $2 million US a day to run, and it's paid for by the American taxpayer. So there we go.
Oh, wow. That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm guessing Google and that pay them. So, I mean, they probably...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if you own a Garmin, when you buy your Garmin, there's a bit of money goes towards the system there, I'm guessing.
But anyway, so coming back to everything, the less pilots, better automation. And now let's hook up an autopilot to this all.
Yeah, okay. So the most basic flight mode we as pilots can operate the aircraft in is by hand flying the aircraft. However, this reduces our capacity to monitor other aspects of the aircraft's trajectory. And remember, we are also the navigator, the flight engineer, and radio operator. So using the autopilot actually frees up our mental capacity.
So as a pilot, it's not too relaxing when you're manually flying the aircraft, because you can't look at the other systems as such.
The autopilots on today's aircraft are very well designed, but they need some guidance from the pilot or a computer to be told what to do. We have some boxes or dials we can set to tell the autopilot what to do. And on a Boeing, for example, there's a thing called the Mode Control Panel, or MCP, and this is a box for speed, heading, altitude, rate of climb or descent. And the Airbus has a similar panel as well. So if, for example, the autopilot is flying the aircraft on a heading of 270 degrees and I want it to turn to the right onto a heading of 300 degrees, I simply rotate the dial to the right to 300 and I ensure the heading mode is engaged and the aircraft will turn a nice level turn onto a heading of 300 degrees. Likewise, if I was flying at 24,000 feet and I wanted to climb to 28,000 feet, I'd set 28,000 feet in the altitude window and hit a button and the airplane would go into a climb to 28,000 feet. And this is the same for airspeed changes and rates of climb or descent changes as well.
So you'd loosely term these basic modes, and these are the modes which you're telling the autopilot what you want the aircraft to do.
Yeah, that's right. There is a more accurate form of operating the aircraft, and this is through a computer. And on the Boeing, it's called the Flight Management Computer, or FMC. And on the Airbus, it's called a Flight Management System, or MFS.
Both, in essence, perform the same task. They have a memory of all the waypoints or navigation points around the region or world, aircraft parameters and procedural approaches in them.
Yeah. So before departure, a load of information goes into the flight computer, mainly the route, the altitude, the weight of the aircraft, and the winds en route. The system then works out a predefined horizontal and vertical profile that it will fly, and it will endeavor to follow this to optimize the flight in relation to fuel burn and or flight time. And on the Boeing, these two modes are called LNAV, which stands for lateral navigation, and VNAV, which stands for vertical navigation.
So we have three modes of flying. Hand flying, using a loss of one pilot's capacity. Basic modes via the autopilot, the pilot telling the aircraft where to point, and the computer-generated optimum plan also using the autopilot.
Yeah, that's right. So the last piece of navigation I want to talk about relates to landing, and particularly in low cloud or fog. The early days of flying, the pilot's navigation instruments, they used beacons on an airfield called non-directional beacons, and you tuned into the frequency. And you had an instrument in the cockpit and it had a needle and it would simply point in the direction of the beacon. It wasn't very accurate. It swung around a bit as well.
And then something called a DME came out, which stands for Distance Measuring Equipment. And this was another frequency and would measure your distance from the DME beacon, getting more accurate.
Yeah. And then they had a thing called a VOR come out, which was the Omni directional range that came next, and this was more accurate. And it works like this. Say you're driving down the middle of the road and you had a stick hanging off the visor above your head directly in your line of vision. Now, this stick hanging down is attached at the top of the visor, but it's on a rail, so it can move left and right on this rail. But the stick, it has a sensor in it, and this sensor is connected by magic to the middle of the road. Now, as you veer left off the center line of the road, the stick moves to the right on that visor track, and only your right eye can see it. It is telling you that you need to bring the whole car back to the right. And as you do so, the stick moves left, and the stick goes back to the center in your line of vision when you're back on the center line of the road. Does that make sense, James?
Yeah, so it's basically, if you're driving along the road, you've got a stick in front of you, and the stick sort of glued to the middle of the road as such. And if you move to the left, the stick's going to go to the right and vice versa. And it's going to be in the middle when you're in the middle.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the basic concept there of a VOR. And using that concept, let's go one step further and talk about the instrument landing system, or ILS.
So it uses the same concept as the VOR needle in your car, or stick in your car. We call them a pointer or an indicator. In simple terms, a beam is extended way out from the center line of the runway, and the pilots tune their ILS into this. If the vertical needle goes to the left, you need to fly the aircraft to the left to get back on the center line, and vice versa. But we also need to know our descent path or glide path to the runway. And we use the same concept as keeping on the center line, but this time a horizontal needle or pointer is on our display. And that shows us whether we are on an accurate glide path. Most runways with an ILS have a 3-degree glide path for them, and that is that we descend 300 feet for every nautical mile. So at a sea level airport, 3 miles out from the runway, and on our glide path, we should be about 900 feet. Now, if we were low at this stage here, 3 miles out, then the horizontal needle would be higher on the instrument. So we'd need to fly the aircraft up to capture the needle and put it back on that center of the glide path, and vice versa. So two pointers, one vertical to show whether we are left or right at an extended center line, and the other being horizontal, showing whether we are above or below the optimum glide path for the runway.
The ILS is very accurate, so much so that on modern approved aircraft, we can engage the autopilot and let the plane land itself.
Yeah, that's right. So to be able to do this, the aircraft that has three autopilots functioning all the time, so there's a redundancy or backup, we couple the autopilot to the ILS and we monitor it. And that, folks, is simply how we can land an aircraft in zero visibility. But during a bit of research on the history of landing in fog, I discovered that Jimmy Doolittle, as a famous pilot during the war. He was the first pilot to take off, fly, and land using instruments alone. And that was back in 1937. And he definitely didn't have an ILS. So I wonder how many pilots tried it before him.
They weren't alive at the end.
I'm guessing, like we do in instrument training, he was probably had a cover over his head, and there was another pilot sitting next to him who was just monitoring in case something went wrong.
So all in all, today's flight instrumentation is very well thought out, with many backups built into the design, with a view not only to keep the aircraft within its designed parameters, but also to interact with the pilots. They're not overloaded to the point of losing their situational awareness, or more to the point, keeping them on top of managing the aircraft and its trajectory, and using the modern instrumentation to also perform the jobs of the navigator, radio operator, and engineer.
Yeah, that's right. That pretty much sums it all up. Well done. So enough about that there. That's episode 21. What are we going to talk about in the next episode, episode 22?
Next episode, we're talking more on system backup and redundancy, the doors and slides, how they work and why you won't be able to open them in flight, and how the toilets work and the water tanks inside the plane, because the aircraft aren't just dropping feces everywhere.
Yeah, oh, that's very delightful. Nice way to finish up. Okay, well, it's from me. Thank you very much for listening. Look forward to chatting to you on the next episode.
Yeah, and from myself as well. Have a good day, and I hope you learned something new. Goodbye.